Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up, including the latest on the RSV virus in the St. Louis area. We'll hear from Katie Couric about breast cancer awareness, specifically dense breasts. And we'll hear from a local psychiatrist about how to help our kids deal with their fears following this past week's school shooting here. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchold. Dr. Buchold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchold, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always my pleasure, Fred.
So we're hearing a lot this week about a triple-demic coming this fall and winter. What is that?
Well, you know, every winter there's kind of a surge of what we call viral infections. What we worry about is viral respiratory infections, so infections that affect our lungs, and what leads people to get really sick and hospitalized is usually with issues with breathing. So we all know and have dealt with COVID. That's been for the last few years, and we've talked ad nauseum about. There's a traditional flu, which kind of, you know, affects, you know, we call it flu season for a good reason. We always expect to get it, but the degree and severity and numbers vary kind of year to year. And then for a lot of kids, are also very susceptible to something called RSV or respiratory syncytial virus, which is a common infection, particularly for younger kids. So the concerns have been, and there's lots of kind of different points that raise kind of, you know, a concern about what the winter is going to look like. Right now in the pediatric hospitals, as an example, I was just talking to a colleague yesterday who just finished inpatient service over at Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. And the sheer number of RSV cases right now was, in her words, insane. This is something you kind of expect to see, particularly in kind of the height of winter. So December, January, February, and they're seeing the numbers they see then now, which is very, very strange. And so I think children's hospitals across the U.S. are really dealing with a surge of kiddos getting very, very sick. You know, she was telling me about a kid that needed something called ECMO, which is kind of the most extreme machine we have to keep people alive, and it just is just tragic to hear this. So it can be very serious and very potentially deadly for the adults, which is my world. You know, we've had COVID, and that still is a concern. There's newer variants, and people are still getting sick. And then the concern about flu, and we have not really had flu for the last few years. There is a reasonable concern that flu may be particularly difficult to deal with this winter once the season, so to speak, starts. To my knowledge, we haven't had a lot of cases yet. I think there's been a smattering, but I think many of us are expecting it to come, and who knows what it will tell once winter hits and we kind of hit those kind of peak months.
President Biden this past week got the new COVID booster, and he urged Americans to do the same.
As we enter this new moment in the battle against COVID, get vaccinated. Update your COVID vaccine.
What's your reaction to another booster and the efficacy of these updated COVID-19 boosters?
Yeah, you know, Fritz, I always get nervous when I talk about this because it's a nuanced conversation. You know, there's newer boosters out that are kind of tailored to the more modern variants or the more current variants that we're seeing in the United States and worldwide. And the logic of that is pretty sound, right? You know, so you're, you know, as the evolution of COVID has occurred, you're trying to stay ahead of the game and try to protect against the new emerging threat. So let's just give an example just of the thinking of this. You know, when we were talking way back when, Fred, in late 2019 and early 20 about COVID, and, you know, we're wondering if it's going to come here, if it's not, or, you know, how is it going to impact the U.S. or not. And, you know, it was a big unknown until slowly, you know, I still kind of think about this. It was like the tsunami, the slow tsunami that was coming over January, February, and then late February, early March is when we really first started to get that first kind of large wave. If we had a vaccine or developed a vaccine that wasn't really well tested, but we thought it was safe, we had some data to say it was safe, and we thought we can anticipate what COVID would do and could give people vaccinations. And at the time, if we remember, everybody was super scared. I think the uptake of that vaccine would probably be pretty high. That's just a guess. But none of that would be backed by good, robust scientific data, because the time to do that type of work is non-existent, and you were dealing with a public health emergency. So policy experts, all they're doing is making a guess, or all they would do in that situation is make a guess. And you have no idea of whether or not it worked or not, you know, because you make predictions about things. We do it all the time. It never really pans out. Like, our predictions are really never right. So when we got, you know, again, going with this hypothetical, we had a vaccine and then COVID didn't really hit us very hard. Is it because, you know, the way COVID was, or is it because of the vaccine? It's hard to know. So fast forward to modern times, to, you know, 2 years later, we now have a vaccine. We can predict how it's going to evolve and see that and adjust a vaccine to prevent that. We don't have the scientific data to really show if it works or not, because we're trying to anticipate these things rather than look in retrospect. And so the CDC has made a lot of educated guesses about where the COVID virus is going or where it is and giving us the protection for it. And that's what the newer vaccines have shown. There's now some data showing that, well, does the current form of the vaccine or the original form of the vaccine, is it any better, any worse than the newer forms? And the answer is maybe, maybe not. We don't know, but it's a lot of things now say it may not make much of a difference. We don't know how things are going to look 3 to 6 months from now. So it's hard to really predict this. And to be fair to people that are making these decisions, it's not an easy, nor do I think there's a right decision to make. You just make the best decision at the time. And then, you know, history will unfold to show whether or not that was the right decision or not. And when I talk to a patient about this, as you can tell, an incredibly complicated situation. I think if you've been vaccinated, you know, with the original 2-dose vaccination, that's good. If you've had a booster, that's a little bit better. If you get that second or third booster, does it provide you some extra protection? Probably. Does it prevent you from getting the infection? Maybe, maybe not. Does it probably reduce the severity of illness if you do get it? Probably. And I think, you know, these words of probably or maybe not are really nuanced, heavy words, because the answer is we don't really know. I kind of think of it as a risk-reward situation, as I always do. The risks seem to be pretty low. And I think if you're high enough risk, so if you're above the age of 50, if you have other medical conditions, if you were somebody that got COVID that you'd really be set back in one way or the other, the odds were, it makes a lot of sense to get that booster. Just know that we're dealing with a bit more unknowns than we were dealing with, say, a year ago. And I think if you have questions about that, I really encourage you to get good, reliable sources that, you know, understand the nuance of this and kind of veer away from hyperbole, because in the Twitterverse, you know, there's a lot of discussion about this, good and bad. And I think, you know, somebody that's criticizing policy experts like the CDC have to understand that this is not an easy decision. And I think no matter what, one way or the other, you're going to be criticized. And then there's others that, like, understand that these are difficult decisions and, like, kind of weigh the pros and cons and everyone makes their own decision. So very, very long answer to, like, I think generally, yes, in principle, getting the vaccine is a good piece of business. But I think if you have questions about this, you know, talk to your physician, read good literature about this that can provide that if you're really having some questions, and kind of avoid the extremes of this, because they're all, I think, have a different agenda to push that I'm nervous about.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time again this week. Really appreciate it.
Fred, it's always my pleasure. I really appreciate it as always. And thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll get the latest on the RSV virus outbreak in the St. Louis area. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela is the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
Cases of a respiratory virus known as RSV have doubled in more than 25 states and are overwhelming many hospitals. CBS's Nora O'Donnell has more.
Dr. Sarah Coombs works in the emergency room at Children's National, where she's been treating RSV patients.
Are the symptoms more severe this year?
Yes. And that exactly goes to why the hospital is full and why we have so many children needing admission as opposed to being able to be seen and discharged home.
In D.C. and 36 states, RSV cases are rising at an alarming rate as a trio of viruses, COVID, the flu, and RSV, are filling hospitals to capacity. All three viruses have common symptoms, often starting with a fever, congestion, and runny nose. COVID can cause a sore throat and digestive issues. RSV causes wheezing and coughing. Doctors say if your child is having difficulty breathing, pulling in their chest, flared nostrils, or blue around their nose and mouth, you should seek medical care immediately. In Texas, when the Thompsons saw their 7-month-old baby Miles was lethargic and not eating, they took him to the emergency room.
Don't wait. Don't think it's going to get better on its own.
Well, and Dr. Coombs told us she's concerned about how early this spike of RSV is happening, and that it means it could be a long winter for emergency rooms. Now, her advice to parents is remain calm, keep an eye on your child when they're sick, and try and stick with these basic preventative measures like washing your hands.
So how are we doing locally? Dr. Jamie Condis is a Washington University pediatric emergency medicine physician at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Dr. Condis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what are we seeing in the St. Louis area when it comes to RSV?
Yeah, so RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, is a common respiratory virus that most children will get before they're 2 years old. What's interesting about what we're seeing in our area and around the country right now is we're seeing a surge much earlier in the year than usual. Normally, RSV cases peak in December and January, and so we're seeing similar numbers to what we've seen in past years, but just much earlier than usual. And so a lot of these children are requiring hospitalization, so it's making the hospitals very full right now, and a lot of them are coming to the emergency departments. So our emergency departments have been very busy as well.
Why do you think they're coming so early?
I don't know that we know for sure. The RSV season the last couple of years has been abnormal. We saw many fewer cases during 2020, probably because a lot of families were keeping their children at home and were masking. And the way that RSV spreads is from person-to-person contact. So a lot of times children will get it in daycare settings or school settings, and we just didn't have as many children in those settings in 2020. So we started to see a real resurgence of RSV in spring of 2021 when there were some guidelines relaxed and children and we're getting out more and being around each other more. So I think that the timeline for when we normally see RSV just really hasn't gone back to normal. Because in 2018, 2019, we really hit that peak around December, January. So I think the whole season is just still a little off.
What are the symptoms for RSV?
Well, they can range. So in older children and adults, the symptoms are usually more like having a common cold or an upper respiratory tract infection. So symptoms may include a fever, a cough, congestion, sneezing, a runny nose. For younger infants, it might include fussiness or poor feeding. But what we worry about is more symptoms of a lower respiratory tract infection or bronchiolitis. Those symptoms may include those cold symptoms plus fast breathing, flaring of the nostrils. For the young infants, they can have what we call head bobbing with breathing, which shows that they're having struggling breathing. They may grunt during breathing, or they may have what we call belly breathing, where they're really struggling to breathe, so you can see them tugging at their ribs or tugging at their lower neck. And they may have wheezing. So we get worried when children are struggling to breathe. They also can get dehydrated because they're struggling to breathe and they're congested, so they're not eating as well. And so for the very young infants, they can get dehydrated rather quickly.
How is RSV treated?
Well, unfortunately, it's a viral infection, so there's no really medication treatment like there are with other infections. There's no antibiotic or something like that. So it's really just treated with supportive care. If the child has a fever, you can give them Tylenol, or if they're 6 months or older, you can give them ibuprofen. Oftentimes, we'll recommend suctioning their nose with a bulb suction, and you can put some nasal saline in their nose and then suction that. That sometimes helps them breathe easier and feed better. You could try using a cool mist humidifier. That sometimes helps break up the mucus and allow for easier breathing. And also just trying to really push the fluids, especially with the younger infants, because they can get dehydrated so quickly. So potentially feeding them smaller amounts but more frequently, or potentially supplementing them if they're not wanting to breastfeed, maybe trying to bottle feed, something like that. But really just encouraging them to eat more frequently.
Tell us about the monoclonal antibody treatment that's available.
There is a monoclonal antibody treatment that is available, but only for high-risk infants. So it's not available for everybody. Typically, it's given to what we call high-risk infants, which would be infants such as formerly premature infants, or infants that have some other kind of underlying medical condition. So if families are interested in this, they would want to contact their pediatrician, who would let them know if their baby is a candidate for that treatment.
But no vaccine, right?
Unfortunately, no vaccine. Scientists are studying this, just as they're studying many viruses, to see if we have a vaccine option in the future. But right now, no.
We're talking with Dr. Jamie Condis. Dr. Condis is a WashU pediatric emergency medicine physician at St. Louis Children's Hospital. So as an emergency medicine physician, let's talk about going to the ER. When and how should you make use of the ER when it comes to your kids?
Well, obviously, we want people with true emergencies to come to the ER. We always want them to know that the ER is here for them. But with RSV, as I mentioned, many of these infections will not be severe. So we don't want families to utilize the ER, for example, just to get their child tested. If they hear there's been an RSV outbreak at daycare and they want their child tested, but their child is doing fine, that would not be a time to come to the ER. Or if they just want reassurance that their child is doing well, but they're overall well-appearing, that would be a time to call their pediatrician or head into their pediatrician's office. If the child is having more mild symptoms, such as what I mentioned before, the cold symptoms, the congestion, the cough, the sneezing, the runny nose, and they just want their child evaluated, that, again, would be a good time to go see their pediatrician or potentially utilize one of our urgent care or convenient care locations. We really want the children coming to the ER when it is truly seeming to be emergent. So if they are having difficulty breathing, they're seeming like they are in distress, or they're appearing very dehydrated, they haven't been eating or drinking, they're not making wet diapers, The other ones we encourage to come to the ER would be the very young infants, because those are the ones who are most likely to be hospitalized and most likely to have severe infections. So the infants who are less than 8 weeks of age, if they are having symptoms of RSV, they would be ones who would be more likely to be served in the ER.
Dr. Kondis, what's your take on flu shots for kids?
Definitely they should be getting flu shots. You know, our big concern, since we are seeing such an early and large peak in RSV infections, is that we are going to see the same with influenza, an earlier surge and a big surge. It's difficult to predict, just like RSV, because we have seen lower numbers the last couple years with COVID. But we are predicting that we may have a big surge in influenza as well. So anything that families can do for prevention, we are encouraging. And children 6 months and up are eligible to get an influenza vaccine, which are very safe. They've been around for many years. All of the pediatric practices in town are offering them. Many are offering them on weekends. Just check with your doctor, but they're making it very easy to get. So definitely encouraging all the kids to get their flu shots.
And what's your take on the COVID booster for kids?
COVID boosters for kids are also available for the older children, or the primary series is still available for children 6 months and up if they haven't gotten that. So definitely check with your pediatrician on that as well. Many of the pediatric offices in town and the hospitals as well still have those COVID shots available for children. Anything we can do to reduce kids' risks of getting respiratory illnesses so that they can stay in school and be in all of their activities, that's what we're encouraging. So any type of prevention is great.
Dr. Kondis, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for addressing this. Thank you.
Dr. Jamie Kondis is a Washington University pediatric emergency medicine physician at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll talk with a local mental health expert with some tips on how to help our kids cope after that school shooting this past week in South St. Louis. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
It's been a sad week as we all begin to deal with the tragic shooting on Monday at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts Magnet School at Kings Highway in Arsenal. How are kids and staff and students and young people in general going to process all that information? Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Sheila Radke. Dr. Radke is a psychiatrist with the Mercy Intensive Outpatient Behavioral Health Program. She's also a child and adolescent psychiatrist with Mercy and medical director for child behavioral health services in ERs across Mercy. Dr. Radke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. I'm happy to help.
So what can we expect to see when it comes to emotions and feelings from students and staff and all those involved in the school shooting earlier this week?
Well, I would say that it depends on the age of the child. So for an older child, we may see increasing anxiety symptoms. You might see some sadness. It might show itself as being more irritable and angry, frustrated. With younger kids, siblings, you might see changes in sleep patterns, appetite, lack of concentration in school, things like that. Little ones, preschool age, you may see kind of some regression in some of their active skills. Maybe they have more issues with potty training or maybe some adjustments in terms of their management of their routines. They might be more clingy or a little more emotional.
What about physical complaints? I've got a headache. I've got a stomach ache.
Yeah, you definitely could see more of that as well, and that would apply to all the ages.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the parents' response should be if they see their kids struggling with this in the days and months ahead. What should they be doing?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would do as a parent is make sure that you're taking care of yourself. You really want to be gentle with yourself, compassionate towards yourself, and make sure that you are in a healthy place. That's because children learn a lot more from us in terms of monitoring what we're modeling than they pay attention to what we say. Most people with kids probably would agree with me on that. So what we want to try to do is provide an environment where people are seeing the adults in their lives, the leaders in their lives, as calm and reassuring about the trustworthy people that are there to support them, about the safety measures that are in place. So we want the parents to, first of all, communicate that calm, safe place with their children. We also want them to spend more time together so that they can monitor and kind of get a sense of the their children's emotional state. So spending time together as a family, doing creative things together, that could be very helpful. One of the ways that all of us heal when we are recovering from trauma is to do something about it. So writing a letter of thanks to, for example, maybe Representative Cori Bush or the police commissioner, Michael Sack, people who stepped up and really worked hard to care for us in the midst of this, that can be a way that children can express themselves and engage in caring for the community and doing something about it.
How should our response differ depending on the age of our child?
Yeah, so if you're talking about a preschooler, for example, we really want to limit their exposure to these events if possible. We really don't want to expose them to media, if possible, about it. We want to make sure that the daily structure of their lives doesn't change. If they're 8 or less, they really are going to struggle with placing this event into a realistic context. So they won't understand it very well. So we don't want to bring it up at that age unless they do. If we have, if there's a risk that people will talk about it at school, then definitely we would want the trusted, loving parent to be the one to share about that. But we want to keep it pretty simplistic and provide kind of those limits, like we were talking about before. We really want them to be able to see the safe leadership, the supportive structures in place that are there to care for them. If they're older, they're going to be more vocal about asking questions about if they're safe. So elementary, upper elementary, and early middle school, they might need you to help them to place the situation in context, but we like to reassure them that these events are very rare, and helping them, again, to identify ways that they can make a difference in the midst of the situation is really helpful. For our upper middle school and high school students, they're going to have a lot of strong opinions about everything that happened, and it's important for us to encourage them to share those and kind of reflect, use active listening skills, show them your commitment to them and express support for their efforts. You really want to empower them and allow their goals for how they want to impact their community to be your guide. So you want to allow them to have some leadership there in terms of what they want to do to make a difference.
We're talking with Dr. Sheila Radke. Dr. Radke is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Mercy. Dr. Radke, I think in the days after the shooting, we were learning more about the shooter who was killed on the scene. He termed himself an isolated loner, and St. Louis acting police chief Michael Sack read a bit of a letter that he left behind. Listen to this, and then I want you to comment on what we can do if you know someone in this situation.
He wrote, quote, "I don't have any friends. I don't have any family. I've never had a girlfriend. I've never had a social life. I've been an isolated loner my entire life. This was the perfect storm for a mass shooter," end quote.
What can you tell your child or your students if you see someone like that? What should you do?
I think that's a great question, Fred. I would say that we need to acknowledge that since the pandemic, the number of children that feel that way is incredibly high. The numbers for trauma and depression in teenagers has gone up exponentially since in the past 2 to 3 years, the relational impact looks like, from the research that we've done so far, to be the main cause for a lot of those changes, since children aren't socially engaging the way they were before. They're not able to use those healthy ways to communicate their emotions and feelings effectively. And there's not as much validation and support as there was in the past. So I would say that this is an example of something that we know is very prevalent right now among teenagers and young adults, and that our response as a community should be to create context for relationship and communication with each other. We want children to reach out to the loners. We don't want anyone to feel that they are alone. And so if we can help our children to not reinforce that through bullying behavior online, if we can help others to see the impact of some of those isolating behaviors, if we as a community can work to connect each other more effectively, I think that that would make a huge difference in stories like these.
Dr. Radke, what more needs to be done in our schools and our local health community to address mental health issues in students?
We need funding for therapeutic efforts. We don't have nearly the number of therapists available for the needs that we have in our community. I think we need to look very critically at the effect of some of our current ways of funding mental health care in general. And we need to look at increasing the number of therapists, counselors, support providers, clinical providers in the field, and specifically enable us to engage in more community supports.
Dr. Radke, anywhere people can go for assistance or help if they think they're having emotional or mental health problems, what should they do?
988, I think, is live now. That's a great resource. It's a hotline for individuals that are looking for different supports in the community, mental health supports. Behavioral Health Response is another network number, but I think 988 is the one that we're using right now that would be the most helpful.
Dr. Radke, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Fred. I hope this was helpful for your listeners.
Dr. Sheila Radke is a psychiatrist with the Mercy Intensive Outpatient Behavioral Health Program. She's a child and adolescent psychiatrist with Mercy and medical director for child behavioral health services in emergency rooms across the Mercy Health System. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll hear from Katie Couric about breast cancer awareness, specifically dense breasts. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Katie Couric, the former anchor of the CBS Evening News, is sharing her journey with this disease. She spoke earlier this week on CBS Mornings.
Katie Couric is an award-winning journalist with more than 40 years of experience. In September, she shared the news that she was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer. Couric documented the screening process and caught the moment her doctor found something of concern.
So, in addition to getting a mammogram, I also get a breast ultrasound.
On ultrasound, what I saw was a mass, and that mass had irregular margins. And I looked at you and I looked at the person who was imaging us, and I said, I think we really need to turn the camera off. I want to speak frankly. So can I stop for a second here?
Oh, Katie Couric joins us now. Oh. Katie, take us to that moment, because it's one of any woman who's been through this. This is the worst process. This is the worst moment for the doctor to say, wait, we need to talk about this. So did you go? Were you documenting it because you felt something, or because it was just a regular, you thought it was going to be a regular screening and you just wanted to take viewers inside?
Yeah. You know, hi, Gail. First of all, you know, I wanted to remind people, so millions of women, I think, put off their mammograms because of the pandemic. And as a result, many breast cancers and other cancers, for that matter, are being diagnosed much later when they're harder to treat. So I really went in to not only remind women to get screened, but I also wanted to talk about dense breasts, because in addition to mammography, I always get a breast ultrasound. So when she said, turn the camera off, my producer was videotaping it on my iPhone. I wanted to say, no, let's keep rolling. It's okay. I've been in this world for many years. I'm fine having you tell me whatever you need to tell me. But she insisted that we turn it off. And the next day told me that I, in fact, had an early breast cancer that she thought could be treated, but we needed to come up with a plan.
But Katie, I hear you talking about it as a TV person, as a person producing this screening. But as a human being, when your doctor, you know, their tone of voice changes, their facial expression changes, and they say turn the camera off, I mean, my stomach would have sunk to my knees. How were you dealing with it there emotionally?
Well, you know, I think my heart stopped, but for some reason, Tony, I just felt like it was probably going to be early. I don't know why, but it was scary, and it was scary waiting for the results of the biopsy, which he called me about the next day. I have had so much experience with cancer, and when my husband Jay was diagnosed with colon cancer, it was stage 4, it was metastatic. When my sister Emily, 2 years later, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, it was stage 4. So I was hopeful and optimistic that if it was something that we caught it early enough, and that in fact was the case. But of course it's nerve-wracking, but it was not my first rodeo, and I think I had enough background and experience in cancer that I wasn't totally freaked out, to be honest with you.
Katie, you mentioned how the pandemic, like many other men and women, has caused us to miss scheduled health checks. Have you always prioritized your health? And if so, what is your advice? Because there's people sitting at home that they really don't think about it. They say, oh, I got time. Yeah. I'll wait.
I'll get around to it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've always been extremely vigilant about my health, especially after my husband died and I became a single mom and my daughters were 6 and 2. I've been uber on top of it. But for some reason, I think the pandemic sort of got us off schedule and messed with our sense of time. And I was at my gynecologist and she said, you're due for a mammogram. And I said, are you kidding? I just had one. And she said, actually, no. You're 6 months late. Yes. So my breast radiologist recommends scheduling your mammogram. And when you leave the office, scheduling the one for next year. So you're on the book. So even if you have to change it, you're not going to forget about following through. But really what I wanted to do by going public with this was to help women understand that if they're among the 45% of women with dense breasts. From 40 and up, they need to find out, because it's only indicated on a mammogram, and then they need to talk to their doctor about follow-up screening. In my case, I get a breast ultrasound. I know Gail does too, but a lot of women don't know this, and 38 states require doctors to inform patients that they have dense breasts, but they don't really give them any information about what to do with that. So the FDA is actually changing their policy guidelines. And I think by the end of the year, all healthcare providers will be required to not only inform their patients, but tell them what their options are and what they should do to follow up. Because unfortunately, even 3D mammograms, which are far superior to standard mammograms, aren't really always that great at detecting tumors. If you have dense breasts, my radiologist said it's like finding a snowball against a backdrop of a field of snow, because it all comes out white. So a lot of women, almost half, need additional screening.
That's why, Katie, it's so important that you're talking about it. You're right. I, too, have dense breasts. We're a member of a very big group, and it's important that we do the right thing. I have them send me reminder notices. Thank you, Katie Couric. A reminder, women should start getting regular mammography screening at age 50. Now the option to start at age 40.
Gail King with Katie Couric on CBS Mornings. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks for joining us. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. or you can download the Odyssey app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.